Hey guys, and welcome to the Animal Training Academy podcast show. I'm your host, Ryan Cartledge, and I'm really excited that you have decided to take time out of your busy schedules to come and hang out today. We're really grateful for you tuning in. And if you have been listening to the podcast for a while, we really appreciate this. Thank you so much. Hopefully you have subscribed so that you never miss an episode. But if not, or if you are new to the show, get yourself over to iTunes, Stitcher, animaltrainingacademy.com, or whatever it is you're listening to this podcast on, and hit the subscribe button to make sure you don't miss a single episode. We are bringing you today's episode on behalf of the Animal Training Academy, or ATA, membership. If you like the conversations in these podcasts, then I want to invite you to continue them with like-minded people within the ATA membership area, which you can find out more about over on the ATA website. Within the membership, you can get access to twice monthly live web classes, the back catalogue of previous web classes, plus a huge library of videos and projects to problem solve different training situations. And we're a sociable bunch with an exclusive private Facebook group, forums area, and WhatsApp chat groups. It's like a Netflix social media platform for animal behavior nerds. But we will get started on today's episode, where we will be talking to one Susan Schneider. Susan M. Schneider, PhD, is a learning researcher, biopsychologist, and clicker trainer to her pet rats and budgies. She is currently a visiting scholar at the University of the Pacific in California and originally obtained her graduate education from Brown University and the University of Kansas in behavior analysis. Susan additionally spent over a year right here in New Zealand as a visiting research fellow at the University of Auckland. Susan's 25 years of research and teaching have produced numerous scientific publications, including pioneering work on generalization and choice. Her award-winning book for the public, The Science of Consequences, How They Affect Genes, Change the Brain, and Impact Our World, describes fundamental learning principles, their role in the larger realm of nature-nurture, and their many applications, including the benefits of positive reinforcement-based animal training. She has keynoted Clicker Expo, Wolf, and the Art and Science of Animal Training conferences as part of 100 book tour events across the US and Europe. The book received advanced praise from experts in genetics, neuroscience, and economics, as well as in psychology and animal training. Its worldwide recognition additionally includes coverage in the top scientific journal, Nature. So without further ado, it's my very great pleasure to welcome one Susan Schneider to the show today. Susan, how are you?
I'm fine. Thank you very much, Ryan.
Oh, it's my absolute pleasure. And thank you for taking time to come out and hang out with us on the show today. It's taken us a good half an hour to get the technology working this morning, but we got there.
Yes, indeed.
Hey, we're going to dive straight in to the first question today, Susan. Could you please start off by telling us a little bit more about your book, The Science of Consequences, what it is, how it came about, and where people can go to find out more information?
Certainly. It had a very long gestation period, and I might comment first, in fact, that it grew out of my academic career in behavior analysis, which focuses on learning principles, particularly operant learning, which is the technical term for what I call non-technically in my book, The Science of Consequences. And most of the basic principles were researched and established by B.F. Skinner, the sage of positive reinforcement, a renowned scientist of the 20th century. And it was reading one of his books in high school that ultimately got me into this field. I actually have 2 degrees in engineering and worked as an engineer for a while, then was in the Peace Corps, and only after that decided that it was so important to apply scientific psychology principles. There were so many benefits that I wanted to get a PhD in that area. And I had come to know Skinner along the way. And so after being an academic for quite a few years and Branching out a bit, including in graduate school, to nature-nurture relations and seeing the bigger picture and how much neuroplasticity there is, how that's influenced by learning. And this is happening with our animals, too, of course. I wanted to get a book out there that would integrate everything as far as that was possible, because there was nothing out there for the public like it. You know, the whole range of applications, in addition to the larger nature-nurture context. And I wondered why there was no book like that out there. Well, it's because it took me 10 years to write. That's why. It was quite an endeavor, it was a wonderful learning experience. And I did my best to include a lot of different disciplines. It's very interdisciplinary. So obviously animal training is in there, but there's a lot more as well. And I have spoken to all kinds of audiences in all kinds of areas. I've been very pleased at the reception from the animal training community. Folks really get it about positive reinforcement example, which is one of the messages of the book, and how this is important for people as well as for animals.
10 years, that's a long time. Wow.
Yes. Of course, I was doing other things for many of those years as well. But the last few years were full time. It's a book that has 700 references for those who want to know more. And of course, there's a lot of resources elsewhere, other books that are outstanding, online resources, videos. There's a lot out there. And again, the animal training community has been marvelous, I think, in taking advantage of this and applying it in so many ways.
Yeah, well, thank you for that massive dedication.
Well, thank you. Once you get going on it, it kind of develops a momentum of its own.
When you started, were you like, okay, cool, I'm going to sit down this year and write a book? Or were you like, all right, 10 years from now, I'm going to finish this?
Well, I knew it would take more than a year, but I did not think it would take as long as it did. That's true. But that's all right. You know, you do what you need to do so that you include everything you want to, and you write it in a way that's readable. And, of course, you have to find an agent and a publisher. And, you know, that's a whole saga in itself, as anyone who's ever written anything for the public knows. And so it just eventually all came together, and I've been really pleased and so relieved. I still have to pinch myself sometimes to think that this really did happen after this original, just floating of this idea with some of my friends and colleagues at the Association for Behavior Analysis, which some of your listeners certainly know about. Again, the main organization that focuses on reinforcement learning principles and their applications. And, we talked about why there wasn't a book like this and agreed that there should be. And I sure never thought at the time that it would be me who wrote it.
And what year was the publication now? How long?
It was 2012. So it has been out now for over five years.
So you're halfway through your second book then.
No, I don't think so. Although I have to say, every now and then, I do contemplate it, because once you've done one, it does become easier the second time.
And so you said it's been very popular with the animal training community, and I can attest to that with regards to the feedback that I've got from people when I just talked to them in general, and they've mentioned your name and told them we were doing this podcast this morning, and they got very excited. Do you think this book was needed in the animal training community and the wider community to kind of make this science more accessible?
The short answer to that, Ryan, is yes. And again, there's many excellent animal training books out there. But again, the whole reason I wrote the book, being familiar with some of those books in animal training and all the applications, including in the zoo world, is because there was no book that provided the bigger picture, some of the basic principles from the laboratory and the nature-nurture relations that were increasingly exciting with what we know about epigenetics, for example, as well as the incredible amount of plasticity plasticity in the brain. And there was all this exciting new research that I was able to follow to some degree. I had a great graduate class in developmental neurobiology, for example, when I was studying for my PhD, that really turned me on to this. And again, the whole interrelations, the way that all these factors influence each other. This is happening when we do clicker training. You know, as we're going to talk about later, I would imagine, you know, there are beneficial effects in the brain. There are beneficial effects on the epigenetics. And this is good to know. I mean, do we need to know this? No, I suppose not. But is it good to know? I do think so. And I think it can add a lot to our understanding of the bigger picture, not to mention relationships between learning and Pavlovian conditioning with its reflexes, and then the third behavior area of instincts, very important for animal trainers to know about relationships among all three of these fundamental behavior categories. And I cover the basics of those in my book. And again, bringing it all together in some kind of accessible fashion, so you don't have to read a textbook, right? Seems to me something that was important for someone to do, and so I did it.
Yeah, and you said there, do we need this information? Do we need this book as opposed to it being beneficial? And we just acknowledge the amazing podcast audience here. We self-identify as behavior nerds, so I'm gonna say we needed this book.
Thank you.
So you said originally you kind of thought, why was this book not already out there? And then you said the reason was jokingly because it took 10 years to write. You then also said that you were discussing with your colleagues at the time about writing this book and why there wasn't already one available. What other kind of reasons do you think the book wasn't already out there? Is it just the longevity and challenge? How many references did you say were in it?
Over 700.
And do you think it's just the challenge of putting that puzzle together?
That was certainly part of it. My own very interdisciplinary background with engineering, and I was an environmental engineer at first, so I had biology. I think that helped. Also, getting my PhD in behavior analysis from the University of Kansas, and even though I was a basic behavioral researcher, that was a very big stronghold for applied behavior analysis for people. And so I had a good background in a range of applications in the human realm, which really enriched my background, I think, so that it helped me see all of these connections. And going to conferences like the Association for Behavior Analysis, where there are presentations in all these different areas, including animal training, but so much else. That also helped, but it was daunting. There was no question about that. And so, certainly other people had been doing very important integrative work. And in a very real sense, as is always the case, right, what any of us do is building on what's come before.
The saying at certain points of your answer there, if it was easy, everyone would do it, came to mind. And so you had the pleasure of meeting B.F. Skinner as well?
Yes, and we corresponded for a number of years. I met him a number of times, actually. We became friends, and I feel very fortunate that he was an exemplar in terms of following his own recommendation to try and emphasize positive reinforcement over aversives, just as we try and do with our animals.
And so you made the connection and you got inspired in that early stage of your career about the importance of this stuff. Now, if we look in mainstream psychology textbooks that aren't necessarily about applied behavior analysis, and I haven't studied many of these. I did a couple of papers at university years ago, but I heard that B.F. Skinner and operant conditioning stuff isn't or doesn't make up a large component of mainstream psychology textbooks. Is that something that you've found?
Yes. In fact, I just gave a talk on interdisciplinary behavior analysis. And in some fields, our associative learning, operant learning principles are, in fact, very well represented and influential, certainly more so than when I entered the field in the 1980s. In others, however, your quite right, Ryan. It's been very frustrating to see so many applications potentially for our principles that are being missed or not incorporated to the degree that they could be, because the science is there. This is a very mature science. I myself did mathematical modeling of behavior, we are able to understand relationships like choice and stimulus control and such in a very mathematically sophisticated way and do applications accordingly. I mentioned in my book something called generalized matching for choice, which applies to people and animals alike, has been applied by Mary Foster at the University of Waikato right there in New Zealand. For farm animals to understand their food preferences in a way that's far more sophisticated and helpful to farmers, because you can quantify the degree of preference that animals have for different feeds or cage conditions for that matter, or rooting materials for pigs even, this has been done. And so you can use that to weigh then the different costs, the different nutritional value, whatever, and it helps you come to a better decision, and it helps the animal's own preferences be represented far more accurately and hopefully with more influence than would otherwise be the case. You reminded me actually of something I mentioned in the book about how for a long time people thought that chickens preferred one particular kind of cage flooring, but when people actually did the research, they found that no, chickens prefer something else. So here again, there's applications everywhere, and it's been very rewarding to see how often that this has been picked up on in related fields. I could name quite a few others, but you're quite right. In mainstream psychology, not so much, unfortunately, although it varies quite a degree depending on the institution and the specialty area.
Yeah, it's so interesting. I came across a paper recently that said, I think 170 behavioral biologists came together and they couldn't agree on a definition of behavior.
Oh, it's surprisingly difficult, isn't it?
Yeah, so it makes sense to some degree, I guess, depending on how you're looking at it. Hey, I've got a million questions, as I always do, but we're gonna move on. I guess actually one thing we should do just before we do move on is where can people go to find out more about your book and maybe get themselves a copy?
Oh, absolutely. Thank you. Yes, it's widely available online and in bookstores. I don't know about in New Zealand, but certainly elsewhere. And I do have a website, scienceofconsequences.com. For the first 3 years after the book came out, I did a blog. And of course, those posts are still readily accessible, and a number of them are on animal training or otherwise related to animals, such as wild animals. I am a bird watcher, so naturally there's some about bird watching and wild birds, if any of your listeners are interested in that.
I actually went to the bookshops in New Zealand to try and find it in December last year, and no one could help me out. I read your book on my honeymoon in Thailand, and I had to get my wife's granddad to bring it over from England.
Oh, I'm so sorry. You know, it should be possible to order it, but perhaps right from a different nation. New Zealand is a little isolated, I suppose, although I do find that surprising, but I'm sorry.
That's fine. I think you could get it online. I was just trying to get it before we went away because I left it to the last minute. So it was just one of those things where I went to the actual bookstore. I haven't done that.
How often does that happen?
Yeah, I know. I was like, hey, Sav, do bookstores still exist? No, I'm just joking. Hey, so much more, as mentioned, to discuss here, but let's move on. As we've kind of identified already, and as a listener of this show, you know that this show focuses mainly on positive reinforcement animal training. We also love to talk about enrichment and the practical application of these two topics. Today, though, as you've already alluded to, we'd really like to take this opportunity to discuss with you the effects that these two things have on the brain. Are you able to please dive into this topic with us, Susan?
Okay, and you know what? I'm sorry, this is where I missed the last part of that question. You are still a little soft, Ryan.
I'm sorry. I was just talking about the effects of positive reinforcement and enrichment on the brain.
Enrichment, of course, is one of those terms that can be very difficult to define, like behavior, as you just noted. However, most forms of enrichment clearly include as an important component operant learning. Science of consequences. And we know a great deal about how operant behavior changes the brain. And I can give some examples. One that I often talk about in my presentations is so simple that we often don't even think of it as enrichment, but it really brings home what you do when you're working with a clicker as a form of enrichment. In this study, rats in a laboratory were divided into two groups, and one group was in particularly barren rat cages. These days, they often have enrichment devices actually in the home cages for animals in a laboratory. But these did not. They had food and water, you know, but that was about it. And the other group also did not have enrichment devices, but they periodically got to be on a fixed interval reinforcement schedule to get food pellets. And the researchers investigated the effects of being on a fixed interval reinforcement schedule on stress and on lead exposure. And you will be pleased to hear that even this very minimal form of enrichment was sufficient to reverse most or all of the detrimental effects of stress and even some of the detrimental effects of lead exposure. This is powerful stuff. We know that learning from consequences routinely adds new synapses in the brain, synaptogenesis it's called, causes long-term potentiation, which means that the connection between two neurons becomes stronger, faster, and longer lasting, and has other beneficial effects on the brain. We also know that enrichment, including, again, you know, positive reinforcement learning like we do with our animals, has beneficial effects on epigenetics. This is one of these really cool areas that's been revolutionary within the last couple of decades, where these are mechanisms associated with the genes, as implied by the name, but not actually part of the genes, and they influence whether a gene is expressed to produce the protein that it codes for. That's what genes do. You may have a gene, and if during your lifetime it never produces the protein it codes for, as far as you're concerned, you may as well not have it. So behavior, as well as other environmental factors, routinely influences gene expression and routinely changes these epigenetic patterns of gene activation. And they do so in beneficial ways that also have been shown to reverse detrimental epigenetic changes that can be caused by stress. So, you know, again, you're working with your animal on agility training or something like that, or just learning something new, and this is having these beneficial effects. I mean, who knew?
Yeah, awesome. Wonderful information. Thanks so much for that, Susan. And so you're saying that enrichment, positive reinforcement can reduce stress. Did you also say that it can reduce, what did you say about lead? It can reduce lead exposure, did you say?
Right. Well, there are detrimental effects of lead exposure, of course. And in a study that I cite in the book, just this very simple form of enrichment of being on a reinforcement schedule compared to the rats that were not, okay, that was enough to partially reverse some of the detrimental effects, yes.
That's amazing.
Yeah, I thought so too.
And so this enrichment and positive reinforcement training we're doing with our animals is changing the neurons in our brains. And the word you use is synaptogenesis. Did I get that correct?
Very close. Synaptogenesis, or right, I think you're right. In Brit speak, or New Zealand speak, it would be synaptogenesis, I suspect.
Synaptogenesis. So, behavior nerds, there's one to add to your vocabulary this morning. And so this is having an effect on the neurons, making them Did you say longer, last longer, the links be more strong?
Yes, that's long-term potentiation. Synaptogenesis or synaptogenesis means what it sounds like, creating new synapses, which is connections between different neurons. Long-term potentiation refers to just one particular connection between two neurons. And when this potentiation happens, then that connection becomes stronger, longer lasting, and faster. And learning is one way to accomplish that.
And is that, so if we're training up new behavior and we're using repetition to build the strength of the skill, is that what's happening in the brain as well? Through repetition, we're making those synapses connections stronger and longer lasting.
Right. There are certainly studies showing that it can. I don't know that anyone has studied this with regard to typical animal training, but it would be a reasonable extrapolation, yes.
And then you went on to talk about epigenetics.
Yes.
And so these are things that, did you say, attached to genes that mean certain genes can be expressed?
Right, yes. In the chromosomes, of course, we have the genetic code on the famous double helix, but there's also other substances that are part of the chromosomes but not part of the genetic code. You know, it's not just the four nucleotide bases, right? There's other stuff there too. And so that other stuff can influence what genes actually turn on to produce their proteins. In fact, a more recent development, which I've just talked about in the presentation last month, is that when you have some forms of learning, the very definition of a gene can change. That is, a gene we normally think of as a section of the chromosome that includes a whole slew of these nucleotide bases on the double helix. And when that gene gets read to produce the protein it codes for, certain nucleotides get read, others don't, because only about 5% of our human genome actually codes for proteins. Most of it does not. And there's something called alternative splicing, whereby the very same gene, that is the very same part of the double helix genetic code, can get read in a different way so that a different protein is produced by the same gene. We used to think that this was extremely rare. Now we know that it's actually a lot more common than we anticipated. This happens in humans, not just in vertebrates and primitive species. It happens quite commonly. And behavior can change the very protein that is produced by a gene. Although the example that I gave was classical conditioning and not operant learning, I think it's certainly quite possible, maybe even likely, then that operant learning is also going to prove to have this effect. More generally, right, epigenetic mechanisms, of which there are four categories, influence which genes activate and which don't, and the likelihood of all of that. And I can go into detail if you want, but of course there is a chapter on this in my book.
And so via learning new behaviors and therefore turning on new genes and encoding for new proteins, this can actually change physical structures?
Ah, okay. That's a different story, really.
Right.
It's more a matter of minor modifications, like DNA methylation happens when a methyl group, a carbon and three hydrogens, attach to the cytosines in a gene. And so that's, you can say that's a change in the physical structure, right? Because those methyl groups are now attached when they weren't before. And behavior certainly influences that. Both enrichment and stress have been shown to influence that, for example. But it's not like you're actually changing the genetic code. It's just you're influencing how it's going to be read in a somewhat different way, or, somewhat more often or somewhat less often.
The more we learn, the less we know.
Ain't that the truth? It's just like science fiction, so much of it.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, if we explained this stuff to people 100 years ago, they would have put us in the loony bin.
Exactly. But again, there's so much flexibility, and there's so many applications.
So in caveman talk, enrichment, good. Positive reinforcement, good.
Yeah, pretty much. Although, as we know, it's actually more complex and subtle than that, but put in a simple, straightforward way, yeah.
is it so having these effects on the neurons, is there any other kind of significant influence on the brain, or is that the main one and kind of branched off topics from that, or?
Right. Let's see. Well, there's others as well, and I'm thinking of a new field called optogenetics, where they genetically modify mice neurons and then have these freely behaving mice doing different operant tasks, you know, behavior of various sorts for reinforcement. Sometimes they do classical conditioning too, and then they can see these neurons light up or not as a function of what the animal is doing, and they also have ways of stimulating these areas and therefore influencing what these freely behaving mice are doing. And the whole area of brain behavior interfaces, like brain computer interfaces, like something called BrainGate that I talk about in the book, that's helping people who were quadriplegic being able to control the cursor on a screen with their thoughts. That was first tested in animals, and they also can move cursors on screens with their thoughts once you get this interface properly set up. And so some really cool science fiction type applications of that, again, involving animal training as well. So there's another area involving neuroscience that's pretty exciting, where there's a lot of new technology and new applications.
So science fiction, like we could like control a cursor on a screen that could influence our animals' minds. And then we could train our animals by thinking about training animals.
Oh my goodness. Yeah.
I remember reading that part. That's absolutely amazing. So people, without physically touching anything, just using their mind, they can control a cursor on the screen. That's what you're saying, isn't it?
That's right. And that's not even that new anymore. That's been at least a decade now, if not more.
And what has there been any significant other things happened in that time with regards to what people can control with their minds?
I hate to say it, but I haven't been following it closely enough to know. It's been really fun for me to delve into all these areas, but, you know, it's just not possible to stay on top of all of them. I try and get the main highlights.
Maybe we could, like, allow animals to tell us what they want to choose, but they could think about something that would come up on our computer screen.
Yes.
All right.
Yes. You know, I would think that something like that would be possible. Of course, we have ways of doing that without needing these fancy interfaces, right? If you know the good training principles, positive reinforcement principles, then the folks that I've spoken to at animal training conferences are just so expert at reading their animals, because that's part of what clicker training does, right? It trains us to focus on our animals in ways that are so enlightening and enriching for us as well as for the animals. You really have such a level of communication. It makes me think of Chaser, you know, that border collie who learned over 1,000 different words, right, and different verbs and all that. And what was the reinforcer? Just the chance to play with the ball. And just what the agility folks do, you know, with these minor movements that they make, or even eye gaze, things like that, that can be very effective. Joint attention, that's a big part of animal training. Clive Wynn has done some great research with that, showing that wild animals like wolves can do that too, as well as, of course, our domestic dogs. And, of course, other pets as well. I don't know that anyone's investigated that with cats, but this kind of, you know, joint communication where you're sharing attention to the same thing and communicating about it in some way is just so cool in itself, not to mention all the applications such as for guide dogs.
Well, we're going to keep being awesome, and then we're going to replace, here in New Zealand anyway, those glass cabinets with electric shock collars in them with little USB plugs that people can inject into their dog's brains. Anyway, I'm being silly. Hey, I love hearing about all of us, so thank you so much for sharing, Susan. Moving forward, I want to dive deeper into the nature versus nurture debate.
Oh, yes.
and your inclusive view on this topic. Can you talk to this for us, please?
Yes, certainly. This is something that I discovered in graduate school in the 80s, and it's really taken off. It's called the systems approach. Nature and nurture always work together. We've known about that actually long before the 1980s, but it's just become so abundantly clear. Some of the examples that we've just been discussing with the effects of learning on the brain, and of course, it works in both directions, right? Changes in the brain affect our behavior, and the same thing with epigenetic patterns. It's all one very large, complex, and very flexible system. And the degree of neuroplasticity, for example, far exceeds what neuroscientists thought would be the case back when I entered the field in the mid-1980s. A great book on this, by the way, is Norman Doidge's The Brain That Changes Itself. Really great for the for lay people. Oh, I see your dog now on the screen.
Stop distracting us, Phoebe. She said the chicken stop coming, Dad. And so talk us through this neuroplasticity. I found that part of your book super fascinating.
Yes, and again, it's just so exciting. Neuroscientists now know there's far more plasticity than they used to think, and learning, not surprisingly, is often involved in taking advantage of it. And so one of the studies I often give as an example by Michael Mersenich 20 years ago at this point, he had owl monkeys that all heard sounds, but for some of them, they were reinforced for learning a sound discrimination with those frequencies. For others, the sound was just background noise, and they learned a touch task instead. And the part of the brain, the auditory cortex, focused on the sounds, expanded only for the monkeys where they had the learned sound discrimination. In other words, that expanded that area devoted to those frequencies in the auditory cortex. For those that heard the same number of the same sounds at the same times, those other monkeys that were touch learning monkeys, there was no change in the auditory cortex, only the somatosensory cortex, which is devoted in part to touch, expanded because that's what they were reinforced for learning about. So here again, we have a very straightforward demonstration 20 years ago that when you have operant learning, then you get these changes in the brain. When you don't, if it's just background noise, then you don't get these changes in the brain. Very direct relationship there. And again, so many applications, including for stroke victims. Let me hasten to add, anyone who knows of anyone who's had a stroke, there are therapies based on positive reinforcement methods, behavior analysis, that are documented effective at helping people recover. And they've shown changes in the brain caused by shaping, positive reinforcement techniques, discrimination training, generalization, the same kinds of things we do with our animals, you know, to help people use their afflicted arms better. And this not only actually produces these behavior changes where they can use their arm much better, but it causes these changes in the brain as well. They've been able to document that. So this is really very well established at this point. And that's not a new therapy either, by the way. That's been around for at least 15 years, maybe more, that stroke therapy.
And am I remembering correctly from your book in those cases, or maybe it's a different area, that the brain can utilize areas that we thought were for other things, but they can replace damaged areas? Am I making sense?
Yes, you are, absolutely. Of course, after a stroke, there is damage to one side of the brain, and then the opposite side is partially paralyzed, typically, right? And we used to think that for control of, like, your left arm, that would be in the right side of your brain because of the reversal, and that it would not be possible to have control switch over to the left side of the brain, but it does turn out to be possible. In fact, it happens even fairly routinely. Because there is so much more neuroplasticity, that is flexibility, than we used to think was ever possible. And I do have references to some of the scientific articles in my book, and I'm sure there's been more since my book came out.
So explain potentially, or just repeat if you've already gone over it, this inclusive view. What is our takeaway message as animal trainers? Dogs are a group of animals where we've got a lot of studies, some to do with nature, others to do with nurture. Explain this inclusive view more. How can we as animal trainers kind of incorporate that into how we think about what we do?
Right. I think just to be aware that there are all of these different factors influencing our animals. We haven't even talked about the instinct and learning relationship, but that's something, of course, that trainers know very well, whatever the species, that there is a lot more flexibility in the so-called rigid, quote, instinctive behaviors than we used to think as well. I give a number of examples in the book for a number of different species. This goes back a century now to Xingyang Kuo, who showed that we used to think that cats had this instinct to kill rats and mice and that it was pretty rigid. But it turns out that if you raise cats with rats, for example, and I've had pet rats, they make great pets, by the way, that the cats and the rats become pals and the cats will not kill those rats. So much for the rigid instinct, right? Not that it's infinitely flexible. I mean, there's limitations here, but there's a lot fewer limitations than we used to think.
And we used to think there were more limitations, and now we still think there's limitations, but maybe there's not limitations.
Not as much, anyway. Again, you know, it all depends on so many factors instinct and operant relationships are particularly important for animal trainers, right? And so just to be aware, again, that there is this flexibility that might be more than you anticipate. But, you know, very important to know about the instinctive side, too, and not to think that you can train anything.
It's interesting. I'm trying to get inside your head. and think about how you see the world with the knowledge that you have, because, you know, of course, knowledge changes how you see the world. And I have a metaphor, or we have a metaphor, I guess I should say, because I don't know who originally said this, but we talk about wearing your behavior glasses, and as you learn about applied behavior analysis, for example, you know, you start to I kind of envision a Terminator with like the digital display and your vision of like antecedent behavior consequences constantly playing out. But like if you're training your rats, are you looking at them and your behavior glasses are like seeing new neural synaptogenesis happening in front of you?
No, I have to say that it actually isn't, but it's nice to contemplate once in a while anyway.
Absolutely fascinating. Hey, great information, and I know the listeners of this podcast are really going to be enjoying this. Next, I really wanted to talk about two topics that stood out for me. I mean, there were so many, but two really stood out for me when I read your book, The Science of Consequences. It's something we talk about a lot on this podcast, and that is the importance of choice for our animals, and secondly, about the importance of variability. Can you talk about these two topics?
Yes, certainly. Choice is often reinforcing for animals like it is for us. And choice, by its very nature, brings an element of control. And control is also frequently a reinforcer for animals as well as for people. So a lot of applications there. I think animal trainers have already been very clever in incorporating choices where they can into training. Of course, quite frequently, you don't want an animal to have a choice. You want the animal to go to the right place in the agility course or whatever, but where you can build it in, just in normal home life, for example, I think it's often beneficial. And that's been shown in studies where animals are under stress, and if you give them a choice, and I've got some examples in the book, then the stress levels considerably decrease. If you give them control, the stress levels considerably decrease. So this is an area where sometimes it actually is reasonable to anthropomorphize because the data are there showing that there is some basis for that. Not always, of course, but certainly it can be. And variability, likewise, for animals as well as for us, the studies on this, it gets boring to do the same thing all the time or to sit in a crate all day. I hate to say it, there's ways that animal lovers have been able to cope with that, but providing variability where you can also tends to be stimulating and reinforcing, and animals given a choice often will choose to do something that offers the reinforcement of some variety. Again, I'm being very abstract here, but I give some actual examples in the book. What springs to mind for some reason is the monkeys who enjoyed watching humans, given a choice between just watching each other or opening up a window where they could see an adjoining room where humans were doing various things and moving around and talking. The monkeys opted to look at us, just kind of like we sometimes go to a zoo and enjoy looking at the monkeys.
That's funny. And does choice and variability, are they having similar or same effects on the brain as the conversation we had about positive reinforcement and enrichment before? I guess enrichment is a form of variability. Or has that been studied?
Right. That's a really good question, Ryan. As far as I know, it has not. But it would be great if it could be, particularly in the case of choice, because we have such a good quantitative understanding of the factors influencing choice.
And so in the book, you talk about how it decreases stress. Is that being measured through cortisol, or is there how are we measuring this?
Exactly. Cortisol, a very good example. That's a stress hormone. And control, having control can decrease stress hormone levels. And that is well established in people as well as in animals, and certainly applies to our pets.
Can you provide one example on choice before we move on?
With respect to stress or just more generally?
With respect to stress would be really beneficial, I think, and I'll be interested to hear an example.
Okay. The one that comes to mind is a classic study with deer mice, where they are nocturnal, and normally they will avoid bright lights because it is aversive and unpleasant to them. They're adapted to be out at night. However, they were given control over whether a bright light would be on or off. And the researchers wanted to see what would happen. Would they just leave it off all the time? Well, it turns out no, that having control over whether it was on or off meant that they did sometimes turn it on and then turn it off again. If they had to go back and forth from one side to the other to turn the light on or off, some animals just repeatedly went back and forth, kind of like I mentioned this in the book, toddlers when they first discover the light switch. And wow, is this cool or not? On, off, right? Because you have control, and it does tend to be reinforcing.
Mind if you love the light switch? I remember very well when he first discovered that. Can you think of any examples of it with adults where they've kind of got, they've just discovered they've got like a light switch, like something really basic, and they've got control, and you've just observed them act like a little toddler?
Right. Yes. Oh, I'm sure that does happen. I'm trying to think of my own life when I have control over something. Well, when you get a new gizmo, for example, and you can't figure it out, and then suddenly you do, and it's very empowering.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely understand that, trying to run a website.
I can imagine. Oh, getting my own book website up, right. Oh, yes, that was frustrating at first.
What about with animals? Can you think of an example where an animal has kind of just figured something out and you've viewed what you would call a light bulb moment, maybe? Mind the pun.
I have an example in the book of, I think it was a monkey that was learning some kind of challenging discrimination problem. It was some kind of problem-solving thing. And this was Donald Hebb. So this is like the middle of the 20th century. This is classic. And Hebb was giving the monkey banana slices for correct steps forward in solving these puzzles. He ran out of banana slices, but the monkey kept on doing this anyway. Of course, there was the reinforcement of attention from Hebb and praise from Hebb, which presumably helped do it, but also perhaps just the intrinsic reinforcement of being able to solve the puzzle. And the monkey eventually did figure it out and then gave Hebb the banana slices. It's a wonderful story.
Yeah, and I think the applications are huge when we think about just managing our animals on a daily basis and how we're, and more so how we can increase the amount of choice they have to become intrinsically reinforcing. It's awesome.
Yes.
Love to add that to our conversation. We talk about choice in pretty much every episode, so really great to get your input there. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
One last thing before we head towards the end, and something that I really liked from your book that I took away and I think about often, and this is the 5-to-1 ratio. Can you please tell the listeners of the show what this is and why it's important?
Yes, certainly. And I want to emphasize right to start out with, Ryan, that it's not the exact number that matters, really. However, for humans as well as for animals, there's certainly been research out there for some time suggesting that in general, for I would say most applications, you want to have more positive reinforcers than aversives or negatives, right? We can relate to this, right? I mean, generally, we prefer to have positive reinforcers in our lives rather than a bunch of aversives that we want to get away with. It's just more fun, and there's all kinds of side benefits, whereas there's a lot of negative side effects of focusing more on aversives. But just beyond that, again, research suggesting that you want to have some kind of reasonably high ratio. It varies. Sometimes as little as 2-to-1 seems to be great. More often, something closer to 5-to-1. I've seen 8-to-1. There's all these factors influencing the exact ratio. It depends on the individual and the context and the behavior, all these other things, right? As is so often the case. But again, trying to focus more on using positive reinforcement generally does have research support as opposed to using aversives. Not that there's never a place for aversives, I hasten to add. There's a time and a place for that too. If I'm camping in Glacier National Park in the U.S. and a grizzly starts charging me, you know, then I am going to use my bear spray. I am sorry if it's an aversive. Right? Okay. But, you know, limited, certainly. And clearly a lot of animal trainers who are going to be, you know, checking out your website and who've gotten into things like clicker training and other positive reinforcement-based approaches have really gotten that and can see that with their own animals, all the benefits. It's just so clear.
So the bear's running at you full speed and you spray some stuff in its eyes?
Well, wherever, you know. Yeah.
What is bear spray? We don't have bears in New Zealand.
Oh, right? Of course not, right? And not in the UK either, do you? Right. I don't know, actually, but it's got things they don't like.
You better hope that it works.
When I hiked in Glacier, I carried a can of bear spray. They really strongly recommended it.
This will make people feel better just before. So the idea is the 5-to-1 ratio, and obviously you've said that's not a fixed ratio. Yeah. There's lots of variables.
I think it's more nuanced, right? Again, it depends on the application, the behavior. I'm thinking now of Ken Ramirez, who for many years was in charge of behavioral programs at the Shedd Aquarium in my hometown of Chicago in the United States. And he didn't like his trainers even to use the word no. He really wanted wanted to focus on positive methods and even limiting the use of something like what's technically called extinction, the trainers often call, I think, at least or less reinforcing situation, right? LRS, is that the acronym that they use in New Zealand too?
Yep.
Okay, exactly, right.
Yep.
Even something like that, that's a very mild aversive. Sometimes, obviously, you have to do that, but you want to even minimize that. The more that you can keep it focused on the positives, the better. And, of course, your training session normally isn't that long either, so that's going to help in this regard as well. Whereas when you're looking at some of the human applications, like a whole classroom session of an hour, then you're more likely to have some LRSs in there, frankly, maybe even a few timeouts occasionally for disruptive kids or, you know, points taken off or something like that. So in that case, or marital interactions, which is where John Gottman originally came up with this 5-to-1 ratio. He has all this research on that, that you want to try for, actually, wait a second, I think he might have been 8-to-1. Anyhow, he had an actual ratio that he was able to determine was a rough dividing line between relationships where couples were very likely to succeed, an indicator of a strong relationship, versus if the ratio was not high enough, then there were likely to be other indications of problems in the relationship as well. And so it's a very different kind of context than animal training.
Yeah, and two things come to mind. One, you know, animal trainers are sometimes better with their animals than they are with their human interactions.
That is so true. That is so true. Do you know about that book, What Shamu Taught Me About Life, Love, and Marriage by Amy Sutherland? I'm not quite sure I got that title right, but it's something like that. It is so good in that regard. And of course, Karen Pryor's classic, Don't Shoot the Dog. Just marvelous classics emphasizing that, yes, this not only works for your animals, but it'll work for your people too. And why don't we all remember this and try and focus on the positive. Like Skinner was such an exemplar, truly. And Mott Wolf, another leader of applied behavior analysis who I knew at University of Kansas in the 20th century, just an exemplar of really focusing on being positive wherever possible and really minimizing aversives. And life is just so much more fun that way.
Yeah, and the other thing I was going to say is, now I remember reading that part in the book, and now I remember you talking in the book about it being significant to marital life, and I was on my honeymoon when I read your book. So maybe that's why it stuck out to me. but it's true, and I think this is something that people can really take away from this because everyone that listens to this podcast already knows this about our animals, and we're definitely minimizing those aversives wherever and however we can, maximizing those reinforcers. But I think the takeaway that I envision from this part of the podcast today is remember to do this with your peers, and if you put an aversive out there to a human, then match it with 8 pleasant experiences or 5. So I think that's a fun thing to think about. But yes. you're suggesting that this guy, I can't remember what his name was, sorry, he did a bit of research on this as well. Was that what you were saying earlier?
Yeah, if you mean the marital research, that was John Gottman. Yeah, yeah. Yes, very well known for that. And that's decades ago at this point. But it was very influential. But again, there's certainly plenty of other places too where people have looked at that ratio. Meaningful differences, for example, the classic from Hart and Risley about early childhood language acquisition, talk to your kids, and provide enough reinforcement. Higher positives to negatives ratio was associated with better outcomes there as well. And prison rehabilitation, there's plenty of applications.
So great. I'm going to look at the time now and say, sadly, that does bring us to our final question for this episode, Susan. Could you, and we've touched on this idea numerous times throughout the podcast already today, but can you please take us all into the future and share with us your vision, taking the information you shared with us today, and in your book, The Science of Consequences, how would you like to see people use this information over the next 5 to 10 years? And or what are some key pieces of information that you'd really like to see added to our understanding?
Right. I think we have touched on a lot of the things that I do hope for already. You're quite right. In particular, trying to take a more positive approach with humans as well as with animals. I would love to see these positive reinforcement-based, evidence-based approaches for animals be used more widely. Obviously, I think those of us in this community generally share that goal. It has been catching on, but we still have a way to go, don't we? It's not everywhere as much as we would like. And for people also, the same applies. We are having some successes, certainly, in reaching out and having this included where it applies. But I'd love to see more. Again, applications everywhere. And let's understand these principles and value them and apply them more than we are now as a society around the world for humans and for animals. I think that ultimately is what I would love to see, and to appreciate the degree to which these learning principles are a critical part of the flexibility in the larger nature-nurture system.
You're wonderful. And one way you can partake in this vision is getting your hands on Susan's book and adding that knowledge to your arsenal. So just remind us, Susan, where can people go to pick up that copy? What's your website?
Right. In the United States Europe, I know you can get it through the popular book-selling websites like Amazon and Barnes & Noble. It's certainly in a number of bookstores in the United States, I know, and to some degree in Europe, I believe. Other than that, you do have to order it, and it may take a while to get there, but the copies are available. Oh, libraries too. It is in libraries in quite a few nations. I know I checked that not recently, but several years ago.
I didn't actually think to go to the library before I went to Thailand. Maybe that would have been, or maybe I did. I can't remember. Hey, Susan, thank you so much for sharing everything today. Before we officially wrap up, from myself and on behalf of everyone listening, we are extremely grateful to you for taking the time to come on the show today. It's super appreciated. Thank you very much, Susan.
Well, thank you very much, Ryan. I have enjoyed it.
It's been an absolute honor. We do, of course, really appreciate all of you tuning in today as well. And if you have enjoyed this episode and were interested in carrying on the conversation and geeking out about animal behavior and training, then as mentioned at the start of this episode, the Animal Training Academy community is waiting for you. Head on over to www.animaltrainingacademy.com and click on the membership button in the main menu to learn all about how you can connect with like-minded, positive reinforcement-based animal training nerds from around the world. Whatever species you're working with and in whatever context, you love all the different ways you can join in. There's something there for absolutely everyone, and we're looking forward to having you join the family. That's it for this episode though. We're going to wrap it up there. Thanks again so much for listening, and you'll hear from us again soon.